It's the Boston Bomb edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Reed and Religion, the Scottish Atheist, and issues in the Boston bombing. Let's begin episode 208.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. Ethan.
Yes.
Did you know you could go to Mars?
I actually did know that.
Okay. Yeah, apparently there's
You haven't been?
No. Not recently, though. But see, this is what happens. 420. I know what Ethan was doing in 420. He made it to Mars. Apparently, what is it, a Dutch company or German radio show is getting people who want to volunteer to be the first people to go to Mars. They do advise you, though, that it's a one-way trip, and but you'll be the first people on Mars, the first colonists, which is kind of cool.
So let me get this straight. Some radio station in Germany or the Netherlands has a bigger budget than NASA. That's how bad it's gotten for NASA.
Well, you know, I mean, to be fair, they're saying they're planning to send the trip in like 2038 or something like that. So, I mean, it's really just it's just a popularity thing. Although it does raise up the idea that a number of people have already proposed that maybe, you know, the first manned mission to be Mars will be a one-way mission, right? Because that would reduce a lot of the complications, issues, because a rocket to launch from Mars to return to Earth adds, like, well, doubles the whole complexity of the mission and the expense of the mission. Whereas if you just send them there and they live out their life there, it's...
Well, I mean, I guess there is potential there if you were going to send, like, a small but well-equipped sort of mini-colony, and you could just keep sending them stuff.
Well, let's be honest, Ethan. I mean, if you were given the opportunity, and I'm not sure what age this would kick in, but I'm quite sure at some point you'd sit there and say, okay, so I might be dead in about 5 years, but I'd be the first friggin' person on Mars. I think I might be, you know, willing to do that. If I had, you know, kids, maybe not. But I mean, that you'd live for, you'd live forever. You'd be famous. You'd be bigger than Neil Armstrong, maybe.
Probably. Well, before we get started today, I want to give a quick thanks to all of our listeners who sent us their thoughts regarding last week's segment on piracy. It was really interesting to hear what they have to say. Incidentally, shortly after that episode came out, I saw a talk by author Neil Gaiman on the subject of the changing face of publishing. And he touched on things like piracy and ebooks and publishing technology. It was very interesting, and I think that it's pretty relevant to some of the things that we discussed. So we'll have a link to that in our show notes, so I encourage you to check it out. It's kind of nice when we sort of tap into sort of the synergy of the zeitgeist, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it is, actually. And I listened to it, and I really liked some of the things he said. I really laughed at one of the things. Well, I'm not sure laughed the right word. He was relating one of the experiences where he was on a panel with other book authors, and they were signing autographs. And the famous person there, someone had come up with a library copy that they bought secondhand or something. And the author said, "Hey, everyone, this is they didn't buy this. I didn't get anything out of this. Screw them, I'm not signing them." Mm-hmm. And how he said, well, you know, a few people in the audience then went and bought a book and went to him to get him to sign it.
Yeah.
Right? And he's willing to sign anything because he figures it's more important that people read his stuff than necessarily give him money, because in the long run, it's a long game versus a short game.
Yeah, absolutely. And I very briefly got him to sign one of my books when he was in Vancouver. So that was a feather in my cap.
So by very briefly, do you mean you said you got 30 seconds?
Basically, like, there was about, like, 40 of us in a line, and he sort of came out and, like, went by all of us, like, really fast, signing books and stuff like that. He said, "I'd like to stop and chat with each of you, but if I do that, I can't sign everybody's stuff." So, I understand.
Yeah, I wonder if he got a stamp. if that would...
Some people do that.
Yeah, I know. But it could be upside. If he stamps it, one, you're going, well, that's not really a signature. But then he'd have an extra 30 seconds to make that eye contact. I'm with you.
Definitely.
But, you know, speaking about making eye contact and making statements that are sort of in the zeitgeist right now, Ethan, you've been listening to Parliament or something. That's weird.
Yeah, normally I don't care. But actually, something interesting has come up. MP Scott Reed, representing West Ottawa, recently made some interesting statements regarding his opposition to blasphemy laws in Canada. And he outlined his position in his opposition in ways that might be a bit surprising to secularists. He had a few choice words to say about atheists. So I want to read what Reed said regarding atheists. Quote, "If our goal is to assign guilt, and this is point number three, then it is also true that advocates of all major religions are, or in the past have been, guilty of repressing others. Atheists have been and continue to be among the world's worst oppressors of religious minorities. I draw attention to the House of North Korea, an atheist regime, and the People's Republic of China and its oppressors of Christians, Tibetan Buddhists, Muslims in the Uyghur region, and the Falun Gong practitioners to make the point. That is probably the world's largest source of human rights abuse right there, atheism. We might want to look at Stalinist Russia, Pol Pot's Cambodian, and so on."
Ethan, sorry, just a quick clarification. You said this is point number three.
Yeah, this is a part of a larger speech that he was giving. So for the sake of time, I can't go through all of it. It is all freely available, and we'll have a link on our show notes. And the reason I point this out is because it's actually, he's in favor of not having blasphemy law. There's no easy way to say that. But he's sort of on the secularist side. He's just being very poorly... he's not speaking too well about atheists right now. But let's consider the overall context. So here's an important quote. "I maintain that freedom of religion, of conscience, and of thought, including the right to be an atheist and have no religion, is a fundamental right, and all others stem from it." And, quote, "Point number five is this. Religions are explanations of how the universe works. It is conceivable that every religion is wrong, but it is objectively impossible that all of them are right. He poorly worded this. I'm actually reading this from this statement. Yes. "Involved in the system of drafting laws, deal with this and with the fact that advocates of each version of the truth feel themselves morally compelled to defend their own version of the truth and to speak on its behalf is the real subject of this debate. This includes particularly how we deal with attempts to convert members of one religion to the other." And to make this point, two of the books that I brought today, the Quran and the Book of Mormon, may both be wrong, but they cannot both be true. It may be that the case that the advocates of one will try to convert members of the other faith. They may feel themselves compelled to try to convert members of the other faith to theirs, even see it as their highest moral duty. So to sort of paraphrase what Reed is saying here is that we need religious freedom and we can't have blasphemy laws because some religious groups can't help but proselytize, and that needs to be protected. So if I'm a Christian trying to convert a Muslim and I inadvertently offend the Muslim, I should not be brought up on charges or held responsible for that offense that I have caused because I'm simply doing what I think is right, trying to convert this person.
Well, yeah. So the idea then is part of my right of religious freedom is to try and tell other people that their religion is wrong, ergo mine is right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, it's kind of an odd sort of argument to make in the case of secularism, but to a certain extent, I kind of agree. I think that we should be free to risk offending religious people, and I think that the line between, in some cases, proselytizing and simply advocating for your point of view can be a bit blurry.
I think one of the things, just on that one note, where, you know, risk not to be offended, which I agree. But it's kind of interesting how there is this concept of offense when you're dealing with religion, but it's almost as if it's antithetical that someone who is an atheist can be offended. I mean, I've had discussions with people who says, what I say can't offend you because you don't have any beliefs,
right?
Which is in itself just an ignorance of what offense means.
Or even what beliefs are. So why the negativity toward Islam or atheism? I'm skipping segments here.
This isn't Sam Harris.
Yeah.
We're dealing with Reed.
Yeah. Well, we will be dealing with it. Anyway, Ian Cromwell over at Freethought Blogs did a good job of explaining some of the faults with Reed's statements. I'd like to add a few things to what he already said. Reed made a point of saying that atheists have and continue to be among the world's worst oppressors of religious minorities. Now, I'm going to call that bullshit right now. I will need to see evidence of atheists going around to communities and alienating, harassing, and blowing up and terrorizing religious people. I'm going to hazard a guess that doesn't happen very often. Reed said that he wants to draw your attention to the House of North Korea, an atheist regime, and China and its oppression of Christians, and et cetera, et cetera. So, again, to prove his point that atheists are oppressing people, he picks two non-democracies with atrocious human rights records, unrelated to religious belief, and then holds them up as beacons of atheist nations. He neglects to mention the most peaceful countries on Earth also happen to have the lowest level of religiosity. So he neglects to mention New Zealand or Sweden or any of the other Nordic countries that have very low levels of crime or history of war and violence. And, you know, it's just kind of a double standard he's creating here. He neglects to mention that atheism as a whole isn't hung up on controlling women's sexuality and reproductive rights, or restricting the rights of homosexuals to get married, or ignoring the threat to climate change by maintaining dominion over Earth, like God said. So he's really sort of strawmanning. He's picking out the worst examples of atheism. And it's not even of atheism per se. It's like saying, you know, he could easily make this argument against people who have mustaches. You know, Stalin had a mustache, and he was bad. Ergo, mustaches are bad.
Well, you know, actually, you're making some good points. Actually, I did a little research on this, and you know what?
What?
Well, it seems that for every North Korea out there, like on the human rights list as being really, really bad, ostensibly atheist as well, there are eight religious nations. So again, even using his own criteria, sure, North Korea is really, really oppressive and really, really bad, but let's not forget Saudi Arabia. Let's not forget Iran. Right, and those are religious countries that sort of say, well, okay, maybe it's not in particular this particular thing. Also, and I'm going to add a few other points here, is Pol Pot's Cambodia, North Korea, Stalinist Russia, and perhaps Castro's Cuba, although technically atheist, they've actually substituted traditional religion for the cult of personality, which is just as dogmatic and just as damaging as sort of your classic religion. So to sit there and say that like North Korea is an atheist country is to really have a strong misunderstanding of what belief is. I mean, they worship the dear leader as a god. I mean, it's a religion. It's just not one of the classic religions. That said, in many countries, you know, where you've had sort of a huge paradigm switch via revolution, you know, the communist type revolution or something like that, the church is actually seen as sort of counter-revolutionary. You know, you either get rid of it, or you have to co-opt it in one way or another. So again, traditionally, communist powers, which is where this atheism gets this sort of bent on, have done a sort of a clean sweep. They've wiped out all the institutions, and of the institutions of oppression of the old state includes the church. So in that sense, it kind of becomes true. But the other option is something like what the Nazis did, where they actually co-opted them. They signed agreements and they got along with it. I mean, let us remember that the creation of the Vatican City was really an arrangement of fascist Mussolini with the Pope, right? So instead of destroying it, they got it to use it for their own reinforcement of state oppression. Also, there's a huge difference between having a belief system and perpetrating a crime in the name of that system. So, for example, China doesn't necessarily oppress their Uyghurs because they're Muslim, but because they're not, quote, proper Chinese. I mean, China doesn't really have a huge love of atheism per se, but they really, really have a big thing for conformity. They want everyone to sort of be the same and have the same. As a totalitarian state, it's easier if everyone is the same in order to control them. And, of course, the image beyond sort of, you know, the cults that I've already mentioned before, I mean, where you get the idea of atheists being sort of repressive is largely in the West and in the context of societies that have already succumbed to sort of religious extremists like the United States. I mean, the reason why atheists seem to have such a combative nature isn't because they're trying to repress religion, but they're saying we as atheists have been repressed by this particular cultural malaise and we're just pushing back. In the same way, it's kind of like saying that affirmative action is racism. I mean, on one sense, yeah, okay, it kind of is, but it's only like that because you're trying to balance the scale that has already been tipped.
Right. Well, I think it's kind of interesting that he sort of didn't understand his own kind of point in this regard. He's talking about the freedom to speak your mind with regards to religious matters. and then makes this jump that atheists who are also expressing their right to voice their opinions on atheism are becoming the oppressors. And I think that's kind of, you would kind of hope that he would have spotted his own loophole there, you know, sort of say, oh, wait, that doesn't make any sense, and correct that. But, you know, there was a good point made by Communist on his blog there that we shouldn't necessarily jump all over this guy, because he actually is making some coherent arguments for the need to have a strong secular state and not to embrace this idea of blasphemy laws. And I think on that case, he's absolutely right. It's just we really need to get past this whole, atheists oppress religious people by being atheists nonsense.
And actually, that leads into something that I think we're going to have on next week's show, is actually, do we need a secular state to have an atheistic sort of state, if you mean that? So I have a question for our listeners out there, is how important do you think it is for something like Canada, the United States, to have this strong separation of church and state? Whereas if you go to a country like Norway or the United Kingdom, where the state and religion are highly tied together, but you have, in an odd sort of way, a more atheist country. What do you think of that whole idea? Send us your email at info@radiofreethinker.com, and maybe we'll have your points on the next show.
All right, well, let's go to a quick break here, and we'll be back with more after this.
Why, sometimes I'd like to take a peppermint and a switchblade and a Cadillac and throw it all on a fire.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio for crazy people and the elderly. Oh, yeah.
ABC Short Film Makers, this 4th annual Vancouver Short Film Festival is now accepting entries until August 1st, so get those cameras rolling. The student recent grads and professional filmmakers can submit films and videos, and remember, the shorter the better. Last year, 29 short films were screened, and over $15,000 in prize we were awarded to busy filmmakers. For entering rules and submit online, please visit the Vancouver Short Film Festival at vsff.com.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Understanding empowers you.
And we're back. So, Ethan, are you a Scottish atheist?
Well, maybe ancestry-wise.
Yes. Well, for those people who are in philosophy, they'll kind of understand why I'm sort of thinking this as the Scottish atheist, or why being a good atheist means you're a skeptic, and why being a good skeptic means you're an atheist. I read an article recently that was talking about the sort of multiple hat scenario of, quote, free thinkers. By that, I mean, it points out that we wear one hat when being an atheist, another when being a skeptic, and another yet, perhaps, when we're being a humanist. The more I thought about it, the more it bugged me that the hat metaphor was somehow wrong, and maybe a better one was armor. Actually, I still like to get a better one than armor, but armor is the one I'm sticking with for the moment. That you can wear them sort of independently, but having them all on strengthens them all. That is, I'm a better humanist by being an atheist, a better atheist by being a skeptic, and a better skeptic by being a humanist. Not only are they interconnected, but they're self-reinforcing. In fact, I could go further, that you can't sort of rush it. Otherwise, you can become dogmatic, and that in its own way is sort of self-defeating. If you call yourself an atheist, well, I mean, okay, on the first level, I should say that the default position is the null hypothesis, i.e. that we're all sort of born atheist. But in our culture, by the time we're in high school, the default is sort of Christian or whatever your parents were, depending where you grew up. So in order to sort of be a good atheist here, you should, when confronted with assertions, at least do a cursory investigation. Many claim you cannot rule out God. Well, yes and no. You can rule out most gods, including the Abrahamic gods, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, because they're logically contradictory. They could not exist. Now, some gods, and notably things like spiritualism, often these are untestable. So, as a good atheist, using our skeptical toolkit, we place them in the, quote, I like blue, quote, category of beliefs. They might be true, but they're kind of irrelevant. Note that to assert that there is no God, again, in a society that oozes belief, is not any more valid than the claims of belief. A good atheist will not believe, again, in our society, because they have a rational foundation for this disbelief. They've confronted the argument and addressed it. Why is this important? Because a number of people who claim to be atheists are dogmatic or indiscriminate, and that this can lead to bigotry, irrational beliefs. The same skills that lead us to reject the gods are also the same ones that necessarily reject claims that all Muslims are terrorists or all Buddhists are peaceful. This also leads to the idea that a good skeptic necessitates atheism, at least again in our culture. If you are only partly a skeptic, i.e. I'm a skeptic of lizard people but I still believe in God, that becomes sort of a form of cognitive dissonance. The same reasoning that leads you to reject the one necessarily leads you to reject the other. If I sort of allow exceptions, then you can be, quote, a skeptic about the effectiveness of vaccines. It kind of paves the way to what I would call bad skepticism. Now, many people believe in the idea of the big tent, and there's different terms for this. And although strategically I can accept it, I mean, to achieve sort of an immediate goal, a collaboration might be necessary. But to me, it's somewhat intellectually dishonest. And granted, I accept I'm being a bit of a purist in this. Skeptical humanists are, I think, the ones who suffer most because often in their moral drive to help people, there is a necessity for them to work with people that, if you're honest, if they're honest, they literally know are either delusional, ignorant, or maybe insane. This may sound harsh, but again, as a good skeptic, then you know you can prove things that the belief in the common deities are logically impossible. So you're working with people who you know must either A, don't know a lot about their faith or logic, they can force themselves to believe something they know is not true, or they can believe a wall is simultaneously black and white. I mean, it must be a little tough, maybe a little scary.
Well, you know, there's interesting counterpoints to some of the things that you mentioned. One of them is with regards to if you're a good skeptic, that necessitates you being an atheist. I mean, there are examples of pretty famous skeptics who don't take that extra step. I mean, you could look at, even go like really far back in time and look at, you know, some of the big philosophers of our day, or well, their day, and say, you know, they didn't take their philosophical knowledge to the logical extreme and go, there is no gods, because there wasn't the Abrahamic faith to believe in. But even someone like, Ray Hyman? Maybe I'm getting this wrong. But anyway, he was a founder of the skeptical movement. He was wholeheartedly in favor of scientific investigation of the paranormal. But he was essentially a deist. I mean, he believed in something. And he freely admitted that it's more about my personal desire to want to believe this than in any particular form of evidence. So it wasn't really cognitive dissonance in that sense, because he was aware of it.
Well, and I would like to point out that, like I say, there's sort of two bends to this, because there are some forms of religion, some forms of spiritual beliefs that are, and I think deists would qualify this, and I don't mean this harshly, but it's going to sound harshly, that don't matter. Right, I mean, like, a deist sort of says, well, you know, the Big Bang was started by God. He disappears, retired, he's in Boca Raton having pina coladas by the beach or what have you, and plays no active role. Some people will say God exists and it is love. Some people will say, well, you know, we all have this sort of common shared spirit. Okay, to be atheistic with regards to those sort of things is, I mean, you can't, because there is nothing to prove or disprove. They're literally unbelievable because there is no, unfactual because there is no facts of the case, so to speak.
It was Martin Gardner that I was just thinking of then, okay. not Ray Hyman.
But the other ones, and again, when we typically think of religion, we think of the big three, and there are a number of branches on that. So Buddhism as in a spiritual movement, probably not something that you necessarily have to be an atheist about, but then it's not making a theistic claim. right? Whereas Buddhism, as in nirvana and you are reincarnated and all that, well, that is making theistic claims. And again, using your skeptical toolkit, I can't see how you can think that one is true and still be the other. And that's where I'm getting sort of this cognitive dissonance.
Well, there's one other thing that I wanted to mention. This is more of a point of terminology, but the way I look at the term, like, Big Ten, which you used, I don't look at that as sort of intergroup terminology. I sort of look at that as inward focus. So, for example, an organization like CFI or I guess you could say like the Richard Dawkins Foundation, et cetera, are big tent groups in that they consider part of their mandate the promotion of skepticism, science, of critical thinking, and secular humanism. Whereas groups like the JREF or the Skeptic Society or American Atheists are sort of single mandated focus. They focus primarily on either science or skepticism or atheism. And the big tent analogy has come to mean sort of the groups that will say every objective is welcome under our tent. And that when you have groups that sort of form intergroup alliances, and a good example would be Eugenie Scott's organization that will occasionally form sort of working relationships with like liberal Christian groups and the promotion of teaching evolution and countering like creationist claims. I would focus more on that kind of, even though I don't really like the term, more like of an accommodationalist mindset, that you're building alliances because you think they're strategically beneficial.
Oh, okay. Just to keep this rolling. So, although, you know, I could kind of appreciate that the ideas of someone like Bill Maher or Sam Harris are atheists, and they profess to be skeptics, we are sort of forced to question both the validity of their belief and whether we wish to be associated with them. Note I say validity of their beliefs, for in as much as they claim to be skeptics, if they don't use sort of the scientific skeptical toolkit as the basis of their claims, they are just as guilty as making assertions of the theocrats that they often vilify. By not using, or at least consistently using, the skeptical toolkits, they go beyond atheism and promote things like racial profiling, their anti-Western medicine, and other beliefs that are shown to be factually false. Now you might say, well, your facts are not the same as mine. To that I say, famously, yes and no. Yes, they are not the same, but they're not my facts. Facts are true independent of my beliefs. I am no less obligated to assess, investigate, and reassess what I think are facts as anyone else. Facts may change not because of my or your beliefs, but because the scientific school toolkit has deemed them to have changed. Why am I so prejudicial about this? Because at the heart of it, the best idea that humanity has yet to discover is the self-corrective investigative method that I've been calling the scientific skeptical toolkit. And it's through that you can reduce ignorance and dogma. You can't reduce, we're humans, we're fallible. There are some things that we think were true today that will be proven to be false tomorrow. But because we hold to this sort of skeptic foundation, we can accept that and we can move towards finding a more accurate truth in the future. Whereas when you abandon that, you're either left with making stuff up or dogma that never changes over time.
Well, I think the great thing about what science helps us understand is that our quote unquote truths are all provisional. Hmm. You know, like we have to be okay with the idea that we're not going to ever have like 100% knowledge about something, and that sooner or later we're going to be proven wrong about something, and that's okay. Because we're making do with the best that we have. It is a way for us to explore and evaluate our world around us. And without that basis, we're going to run into walls. We're going to be like, well, wait a minute. All the science says that it turns out, cells behave this way. We always thought it was this way. We can't change because we know we're right. Well, we're going to hit a wall.
One of the things that really kind of annoys me is often that's used as an example of why, you know, science can't be used as your ultimate foundation is eugenics, right? Okay, so 100, 150 years ago, we sort of started to understand the idea of genetics. We didn't know about DNA, but we had the idea of genetics. And the eugenics program came out. And that was very scientifically based. It was very much, this is what we thought was true in facts. But what's often forgotten about that, and this is where you had sterilization of people who were either poor or mentally handicapped. You had famously the idea of racism and racialism, the Nazis, the whole nine yards. But what's also forgotten about that is that it was science itself that proved that the original interpretation of eugenics was wrong. And it has shown now that there are differences amongst people But those are not the same sort of social constructs that were originally used. We have evolved our thinking, and the self-correcting nature of the scientific method has allowed us to correct, even when science sort of does go off the rails, it does get it wrong. If we're true to the method, it will eventually correct itself.
Absolutely. Shall we take a quick break here and come back with more after this here on Radio Free Thinker? We just played Velvet Dinosaurs and their latest hit, Eating the Plate. Now let's go to the phones and hear what you have to say. Go ahead, caller, you're on the line.
Smash the dirty red scum!
Really?
Kill!
That's really
kill! Bad. Kill! Filthy bastard tummies! I hate them! I hate them!
Okay, well, You know, maybe you should relax a little bit. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
This guy standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back. So, Boston bombing. One tragedy, many dimensions. As most of our listeners know, last Monday there was a series of bomb blasts at the Boston Marathon. After an unprecedented city shutdown and aggressive manhunt by Boston security forces, one of the alleged bombers was killed and another was in stable but critical condition in Boston Hospital. Besides the two blasts at the marathon, the suspects apparently tossed a couple of grenade-type pipe bombs while making their escape from police. The Boston area was completely shut down. I mean, no one was allowed to go to school, go to work, drive. They weren't even really allowed to go outside their homes. Highly unprecedented, highly radical. Now, this event has raised a number of interesting controversial issues, issues that suddenly seem quite pertinent to us as well as our southern neighbor in the light of recent news from Quebec and the suspected terrorists there. First, as I said, Boston was completely shut down. Police were performing house-to-house searches without a warrant. They were even with this massive use of security infrastructure, ironically enough, it was ultimately a guy who noticed that someone had taken the cover off of his boat that led to the capture of the suspect. Of course, this was classified as extraordinary circumstances, therefore an extraordinary response was required. Then again, why was this extraordinary? Okay, it definitely feels different. It is being called terrorism, so does it warrant it or not? Well, I'm not trying to be critical of the authorities' response to the event, but it has brought up a number of people that, well, why is the Boston Boston Marathon terrorism, and yet the Sandy Hook shooting considered a crime? More people died at Sandy Hook. The Fort Hood shootings in Texas were politically motivated. So far, the only consistent things about the bombers is that they were, quote, from their uncle, losers. Although it has just been released this morning, I was listening to a report that they did say they were doing it because they were disgruntled about America's military activities in Iraq and the Middle East and that sort of thing. So maybe a bit more politically bent. But at the same time, it's come out that there seems to be absolutely no connection with anyone other than these two guys just dreamt it up on their own. Now, you may not know this, but one of the bombers actually attended school the next day. He partied that night and even tweeted a sort of stay safe messages on Twitter to people in Boston. It was only after a state official image appeared in the public domain that they hastily tried to flee. I mean, they didn't seem to have anticipated an escape plan or even consider what would happen afterwards. Perhaps they thought God, Allah, or whatever would protect them. But it seems really sort of an amateurish sort of job overall. In the wake of these, quote, new terrorist attacks, there have been calls for strengthening immigration laws. Both suspects immigrated from the Caucasus. One was an American citizen, the other a legal immigrant. There have been calls to label them enemy combatants so they can be treated as prisoners of war as opposed to Americans of the right. Essentially, you can throw them in prison forever. Think of Gitmo in Cuba, where people are still there, untried. There's even been some hyperbolic talk about, you know, hey, where are the waterboards? We can use them now. The argument has been made about, you know, our overreaction to crime versus terrorism and a complete willingness to sacrifice anything, to spend anything to prevent even one death from terrorism, but a consistent resistance to do anything about regular crime. It was pointed out that about 3,000 Americans have been killed via terrorism since the 1970s, while over a million people have died via gun violence. It is, as Chris Hayes has put it, every year about 30,000 people die due to gun violence, and we as a society have written them off as the cost of a free society. Nothing can be done. But one person at risk from dying in a terrorist act, that's one death too many. And again, the irony is that in this week where the Boston bombing went on, the Americans had a gun control law put up where they wanted to have, you know, background checks on people who bought guns on the internet or bought guns at gun shows. And they said, no, we can't do this because it might violate people's rights. Meanwhile, they were doing unwarranted searches of the houses. They passed a bill this week that allowed the government to take, for security reasons, any of your electronic data and use that without any, you know, sort of precondition. It's ironic that this guy who's now in hospital, they know the evidence is pretty clear. He said it. He's admitted that he's done it, right? He can't get on a plane. He can't get a driver's license. But he can go and he could buy a gun. I mean, the disconnect there just seems weird. What do you think about that, Ethan? Do you see the disconnect between crime?
Well, it is very strange. When I was watching the news, and this was back before when they had the suspects, and there were sort of like tweets and rumblings that police were looking for like a dark-skinned male, and sort of everybody kind of just rolled their eyes at that point. But once they sort of had the suspects, I think, reasonably fingered, I was watching like CNN and various news sources, and I was very surprised by some of the coverage because they spent a lot of time talking about Chechnya, which is where they're from, right? And they were talking about how it's a predominantly Islamic area. They were talking about the sort of struggle with Russia. They were talking about the armed conflicts, the terrorist actions that were happening there. Really sort of going back into it. They tried to sort of trace the family's history through the area. Very in-depth coverage. As though, like, they were soldiers from Chechnya who, like, were sleeper cell agents in America. And I'm thinking to myself, why didn't they do this kind of background on, like, the Sandy Hook guy?
Or the Aurora shooting.
Or anything. Like, why is there such a difference? As soon as, like, I feel bad about making this all about race, but why is it when as soon as like a dark-skinned person does one of these things, it's like, okay, are they Islam? Are they from like, are they Muslim? What country are they from? And they go into like all this weird background stuff. If a white guy does it, it's like, oh, he was crazy.
Well, but let's be careful. I mean, they are technically Caucasian.
I don't like using this. I don't even like this, the framing of this, but it feels ugly, you know? And it's just like, there was this, the level of in-depth analysis to their background, where they grew up, the city that they were born in.
Well, you know, some of the things that I thought was really remarkable was that you had two real memes. Is you had a bunch of people, we'll say half, maybe, whatever, that were determined that this is an Islamic plot against America. And then you had the other half saying, please, whatever, don't let them be Muslim or Arab. And it was interesting that was a split. I mean, both of them were both just as racist in the sort of sense, is that, you know, they were all hinging on this one particular feature. And the fact that they happened to be turned out to be Muslims does seem to be playing into this whole narrative. But again, if you think about it, these were essentially large pipe bombs. Sure, very spectacular because they chose well their target. But, I mean, you didn't get the same kind of in-depth analysis at the 1994 Olympics where they had the pipe bomb go off in the park, which, granted, only killed one person because they had a heart attack. But still, you know, I mean, that was sort of the same kind of terrorist. you have lots of sort of quote-unquote terrorist activities by right-wing militia. I mean, their number of cases, but they don't get the same kind of treatment because it's not of them.
Yeah.
And that's where you get – actually, one of the things that someone has mentioned is that if these guys had done the exact same thing and they had used guns, that you would not have had this. This wasn't terrorism. This was just lone gunmen who were nuts that were had these weird beliefs, but there was nothing. Because, again, they don't quite fall into the perfect Arab-Muslim sort of dynamic. And because if you said that they were terrorists and they were using guns in the United States and guns that they got legally, then you have this whole big Second Amendment thing that pops up that seems to squash any kind of conversation.
Well, I mean, one of the trending topics was, oh, look, they committed a terrorist act, and they didn't use guns, so I guess we don't need gun control. Really?
Yeah.
Really? That's the point you're going to make with this?
I wonder, well, see, I don't know what Boston's gun laws are, but whether if having people there had guns on them, civilians, if that...
Well, I mean, Boston, I mean, just going based on my superficial understanding of American geopolitics, Boston is a pretty liberal town, so I would say no. But I mean, I don't know that for sure.
But it still gets weird. But let's just carry this. So another thing that had come up, another weird aspect of this event, was the fact that the surviving bomber is being charged with, quote, using weapons of mass destruction against persons and property at the Boston Marathon. Now, from what I remember of the good old days of the Cold War, or even the infamous false claims of George Bush in Iraq, a weapon of mass destruction is sort of unconventional. It's chemical, biological, or nuclear in nature, and the implications are that thousands to millions of people could die from them. Applying weapons of mass destruction to this bomb of the homemade variety, as was used by the Boston guys, seems somehow to water down the term to be meaningless. It's also an example of what I'm going to call power creep. Maybe a better term for it, but I'm going to use power creep. Originally, laws were passed to give security officials extraordinary powers because of the massive damage that weapons of mass destruction could wreak. I mean, if there's a nuclear bomb hidden in the city, I think most people would say, well, okay, let's go outside of what we think is normal behavior because it could wipe out the entire city. That there seems to be somewhat justification.
Yeah, call Jack Bauer.
Yeah, exactly. However, now that WMD can include something as simple as a pot bomb, these powers, which were originally intended to be used rarely and under extreme circumstances, have become standard operating procedure. Now, this comes home to roost here in Canada, as the Harper government has chosen to use, okay, I'm being ungenerous, to use this tragedy as an opportunity to reintroduce sweeping, quote, anti-terrorism powers. To be fair, these powers were enacted by the Chrétien government in the wake of 9/11, but they were sunsetted in 2007. That means if you didn't pass a law to renew them, they would expire on their own. During that time, the powers, they were never used, and they were deemed not needed, ergo, they were allowed to lapse. I am unsure why the Conservatives think we need to resurrect these powers, but I do fear that this power creep, as I previously mentioned, will come up. And again, I mean, without these powers, we seem to have managed to have caught a number of terrorists, including the ones that were just sort of released just this other day. Ethan, do you think that watering down the meaning of weapons of mass destruction is actually a plot by the Bush people, supporters, so that when history books go back, you can actually say that Iraq did have weapons of mass destruction? I mean, they do have bombs, they did have rockets, so Bush was right, no?
Yeah, well, I guess that's a roundabout way of affecting history, but I mean, the funny thing is, the idea here that they were using weapons of mass destruction, I mean, the weapons that they use could be manufactured by most industrious young people who have access to the internet. You know, like it's really not that hard to make a pipe bomb.
Well, and ironically enough, about the same time, and again, I mean, sometimes coincidences can be really weird. I'm sure there's a thousand conspiracy theories. Some guy who thought that the federal government was harvesting bodies for some sort of big world government plan sent some letters that contained ricin.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, at least in that sort of context, it's a chemical weapon, and we consider chemical weapons to be, you know, uncivilized and therefore sort of a weapon of mass destruction, even though it doesn't have the mass effect, but it's still at least unconventional.
Yeah, yeah. And then compare it to the guys who just threw some, like, pipe bombs into some trash cans.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, even if you sort of believe that, you know, Harper, Obama, whomever, isn't going to abuse these sort of ideas, when you start stretching the meaning of things, like, for example, the claim of terrorism now. I mean, what is classified as a terrorist act used to be considered civil disobedience. And in this, I mean, like, they talk about environmentalists. And environmentalists who will, you know, destroy roads, who might blow up things, which, I mean, don't get me wrong, are violent acts and we don't support. But those were seen as civil disobedience because they were trying to make a claim that, hey, that there's something wrong here, we need to fix it. But now you put this big bandage label over it, you call it terrorism, automatically everything they do is wrong, and you can now do things to them that you couldn't do before, where if it was just a crime, if it was just sort of a form of civil disobedience, even though violent, they got, you know, 5 years in prison. Now it's terrorism. You can take them out of the legal justice system. You can throw them in jail forever. You can torture them. You can do whatever. It's this idea that what was originally seen as very limited, very rare, very micromanaged powers have now just become common day events. I mean, did you see the pictures of Boston with the tanks? You know, they're armored personnel carriers. But I mean, they had tanks on the road and everyone thought that was normal. No one said, oh my God, look at what a police state we've turned into. If that was like pictures from 20, 30 years ago, we would have thought, oh, that must be the Soviet Union. Something like that would never happen here.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads, I guess, into the next idea. We were talking about the idea, you know, of power creep and the idea that, well, you know, the alleged bombers have hinted that the FBI might have been behind the plot, that they kind of knew sort of what was going on. And that, you know, there may be worries that the government may torture him or not. He seems to be cooperating, so most of those now are sort of not believed. But if this had happened, like I say, about 20 years ago, people would have called you for saying that a nut. Now, your conspiracy must be far more inventive to get the sort of nut label. And trust me, listen to Glenn Beck, and you'll hear some pretty wild conspiracy theories. But, I mean, it's sad that you have to go to such great convolutions because, well, the U.S. and indirectly at least Canada, they do torture people. It is now considered a common practice, or at least was a common practice. The vast majority of my research says that, you know, a lot of the terrorist charges on the continent, of this continent, have actually resulted from FBI sting operations. That is, people are sort of identified as being potentially radical. Then the FBI will go out and approach them sort of saying, hey, I've got this plan for an attack. Do you want to get involved? Now, the level of entrapment has been highly contested, but not so much anymore as it was a year or 3 years ago. It's like people's tolerance level has sort of lowered or diminished. Currently, the terror laws are being debated, as I say, in our own parliament, which will make it legal for something called preventative detention. That is, a government can arrest you and throw you in jail for 3 days for no reason at all. Okay, I'm being a little ungenerous. Targets are held under suspicion of being involved in terrorism. However, that's not determined by a court of law. It's actually determined by the minister. They can be placed on a probation that limits where they can go, who they can see, what they can do for up to a year. And if you refuse or you violate these preventative probation orders, you can be jailed for a year. Another aspect of this law is investigative hearings. This is where someone is suspected of knowing something about terrorist act. They can be forced to answer questions, whether they incriminate or not, or be jailed for over or up to a year. And these aren't actually designed to be criminal investigations. These are just, quote, intelligent gathering investigations. You can sort of say, well, you know, I need this information because I want to stop this crime. Well, no, it's like we think you might know someone who knows someone that might help us do something over here. It becomes very gray. I mean, we can, as I say, on the surface, it's like, well, obviously, if there's a ticking time bomb and I need to get this information, great. But as time goes on, these powers creep where it just becomes a normal part of operation to bring someone in because I want to know something about something innocuous. And we lose all our rights. Now, don't get me wrong. This is in 1984. We're not in a Nazi state. And no, Harper is not Hitler. Well, actually, the jury's still out on the last one. However, there is this idea of power creep, ethics creep. In the latest report about the terrorist suspects who are planning the crash of Via rail trains, one of the things that came out, the police report stated that there's links between, quote, Al-Qaeda in Iran. But Iran is a Shia state. Al-Qaeda is hell-bent on creating a, quote, global Sunni caliphate, or at least that's the propaganda. They actually hate each other. They see each other sort of apostates. They don't work well together. So, you know, in their opposite ends of sort of this radical spectrum. This is likely, I mean, so this doesn't seem to be true on the surface of it. And again, I'm not trying to put any ill will in there, so to speak, but it does seem to be sort of a connection made by perhaps an ill-informed officer who's doing the investigation. I mean, Al-Qaeda is portrayed as the root of all terrorism in the world. Iran is accused of supporting terrorism, although mainly it's Israel and Palestine. So perhaps the terms were brought up in connection with the Middle East, and someone said, hey, I assume Iran and Al-Qaeda, they must be working together, whereas most experts say this is extremely unlikely. However, again, this sort of exemplifies the idea of sort of power creep, of how it's dangerous. Is once it becomes commonplace to do this all the time, and people are just doing it by default, it increases the opportunity for errors to increase. It increases the opportunity where an innocent person may be convicted. I mean, ironically enough, and again, I'm not saying the guys that they arrested in Quebec are not guilty and shouldn't be convicted of some crime, but at the moment, it's a thought crime. I mean, they haven't actually done anything. The worst so far evidence I've heard that they had is that they were scouting railway trains to find out what might be a good one to attack. And, you know, like I say, on a certain level, I can see that as good policing. But another level, if I sit there and me and Ethan are chatting about, you know, I wonder what would happen if we did X, Y, or Z, and I don't want to say X, Y, Z, because we might be dragged in as terrorists, even though, well, I know I'm not. Ethan, are you a terrorist?
I'm not a terrorist.
So, you know, what do you think, Ethan, about this idea of preventative detention for terrorist group activities? I mean, like I say, we've talked about, you know, the Office of Religious Freedom in somewhat negative tones, and that's a government office, and maybe someone might say that we're plotting to eliminate the government because we're trying to get rid of this office.
Well, I think that the merits of sort of preventative justice, I mean, it's a murky category because on the one hand, you obviously need some aspect of prevention in sort of law enforcement and protecting from terrorism. Where I guess the question is, how far can you go in that process, and you know, how far do you push the boundaries of the rule of law, where you sort of arrest somebody based on suspicions that aren't really grounded in anything and don't give any kind of forum to investigate those suspicions? That sort of seems to be crossing that kind of, you know, creepy dystopian line.
And again, you know, I'm trying to keep the idea here of focused. It's I mean, 9/11 obviously was the big sort of paradigm shift. But one of the things that was always the good part about a Western civilization was the idea that we lived in a free and open society. And that concept has been continually eroded for at least the last decade. Some would argue it's been eroding for more than the last couple of decades. That we are not in a police state now. But it's much easier to believe that we're on the road to a police state now than it was 20 or 30 years ago. And that's the part that wants me to keep everyone aware of what's going on. Not that I'm going to get arrested on the way home today, but it is significantly more likely that I could be legally picked up for no particular reason at all today. Whereas if this was in the 80s, you couldn't have done that. That you would have had to have just cause. You would have had a search warrant. You would have had, you know, there would have been a lot more protections as me as an innocent person. And we've always thought that being an innocent person, being unjustly accused, had its value. That was part of the things that made a free society better than a totalitarian society. But now it seems like that we're willing to say, well, hey, you know, I'm willing to let, you know, 10 people who may be innocent go to jail if I prevent one person from doing a bad thing. And that bad thing might be doing minor harm. I mean, as horrible as the Boston Marathon was, so far only 4 people had died, right? And I'm trying to put this in the right context, that the disruption, that the hyperness over the idea of terrorism in the United States has so much more damaged society in general than you would be, as Chris Hayes put it, the sacrifice that some people in a free society, bad things are going to happen to you. That is somewhat a price you pay to live in a free society. It's not good. It's not right. People die in car accidents. We don't like the fact that people die in car accidents, but we acknowledge in order to have an effective transportation network, some bad things are going to happen, and that we are losing that cognitive dissonance, that we're much more willing to say, no, I don't want a free society. I'd prefer a safe society. And ironically enough, you tend to have neither.
Well, interesting topic. We'll have to see what kind of feedback we get on this one. So let's go on to our skeptical highlights as we are running out of time. I guess I'll start us off here. I got two here that I want to mention to our listening audience. The first one is the Science of Vaccines, a panel discussion, which is happening Friday, April 26th at 7 p.m. in room 1700 at SFU Harbor Center. And this is going to be a panel discussing the reasons why vaccines are one of the foundations of public health and take questions on the creation of vaccines, how they work, and more. We have three panel experts, Dr. Jamie Scott, Dr. David Sheffield, and Dr. Monica Naus, all will be able to answer questions about how vaccines are created, how they go to clinical studies, and what do we do with them and how they work. It's going to be very fascinating. It's a free event, and it should be very informative. My next skeptical highlight is happening Sunday, April 28th at 6 p.m., and this is a concert, George Harab at the Railway Club, presented by CFI Vancouver. George Harab is sort of a skeptical atheist comedian musician who's going to be in town to do his set at the Railway Club, and then followed by a reception in the back room where we'll have a chance for a one-on-one interaction with George and maybe a small acoustic set. So come on by. You can get tickets for the Harab event at harabvancouver.eventbrite.ca.
You know what would be interesting, Ethan, is if at the end of the show we play a Harab song, maybe if we had time. We'll see if we can do that.
Yeah, we'll see.
And so now time for my skeptical highlight. So I've got three this week. Vancouver Strategic Conference Studies Conference. It's a panel discussion on Canada's role in the Middle East. Panelists will include British Middle East correspondents Robert Fisk, former Army Commander Ed Fitch, Afghan-Canadian journalist and director Nilofer Pazira, and various diplomatics and journalists and historians. It's going to be held at the Vancouver Community College. Tickets are $35 and $20. They're available at Everbrite. There'll be a link. That's happening this April 26th and 27th. My second one is the All Candidates Debate. People may or may not know, but we have a provincial election going on here. The debate is going to be at the West End Community Center for the West End community. Sorry, it's going to be held April 25th at 7 p.m. The theme of the debate will focus on the West End's affordability, housing, food, and senior issues. It's going to be held at the Central Presbyterian Church. And considering today was kind of a heavy day, I thought I'd end on a light note. Drinking with Portals. Geekenders is having a monthly night featuring burlesque, variety shows, costumes, and trivia questions contest. There's going to be geeky dancing. It's really kind of a nerd fest gone wild. It's a little risque. You have to be 19 years or plus to attend. People are encouraged to wear costumes, be they on theme or off theme. It's going to be held at the Roxy Cabaret, the 26th. Doors open at 6 p.m. Show starts at 6:30 p.m. There is a cover of $10, so maybe see someone out there.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, so I guess this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And this is Ethan saying thanks for listening. Tune in next week.
This 21st century man,
God is not great.
To get irate,
God is not great.
Irate,
God is not great.
God is not great. Not from where I stand. Century man can tend to get irate on a scale from 1 to 1, less than 7.